I was telling Ronan Keating he's on Saturday Kitchens.
And he's looking at me and I said, Ronan, you can't tell me when you're decided you wake up with crusty pyjamas. Now, Mr. Bird was the ultimate PE teacher. He was overweight. He wore tracksuit all the time. He used to smoke constantly.
Jump in.
And then so that really sort of put me back. And in the meantime, my dad had just passed away as well. So my dad passed away, I think, a couple of weeks before I shut the restaurant. So I'd say possibly it's been the darkest part of my life.
If you was in an office and you behaved like a chef behaves in the mid-90s and said to him, hey, you, pass me that f***ing stapler before I smash it in. It doesn't work, does it?
So that's changed us, and it's changed for the better. So it's more of a thinking chef's game.
Welcome to B2B Birmingham, the podcast. Today, very special guest, Mr. Glyn Purnell. Thank you ever so much for giving me some time today.
That's all right, looking forward to it.
Apologies for the noise. It is quite noisy down here at St Andrews today, so we'll work around that.
Yeah. But makes you change from last season because it was silent.
Hey! So first off, before we get into you, your life, everything you do, you started a residency this last match, home game, didn't you?
Yeah.
Down here at St Andrews, Narset Park. How did that go?
Really bad, actually. Really good. Yeah, everyone seemed really happy. Did a little bit of theatre at the end. It was funny, actually. So I do this mince chocolate chip. So it's like a story about an argument on the beach with my brother and sister who had the coolest ice cream. Obviously, my chocolate chip would win because it's got the menthol flavour. So what we do is we serve this warm mousse with a mint ice cream. Then I pour like this mint solution onto dry ice and it sort of puffs all over the table, a little bit like stars in your eyes. And one of the guys, you put like a mint solution in there so it smells of mint as well. And one of the guys put a little bit too much mint solution in there. So as I was pouring, my eyes were streaming. And one guy said, it's probably the nicest dish you'd have ever eaten. One, because it was delicious, but also it cleaned my sinuses. So I just thought it was a win-win situation, you know?
That's a great winter pudding.
It is actually, yeah. Rubbing the ice cream on your chest on my fix.
Bottom of your feet.
Yeah.
So we spoke briefly. The podcast is based around championing Birmingham, really.
Yeah.
And the Brummies and people like yourselves that just shouting out about it on a bit of a bigger platform.
Yeah.
So I know that you went to Grimshaw because I know you from Grimshaw as well.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about a summary of your growing up.
I was born in Chelmsford. When I was really little, I was like, you know, from 0 to 2, I lived in the flats opposite the Manford and Kingshurst.
And so it's loaded, boy.
Really?
Yeah.
Redwood Ace.
Sagwa.
So, Redwood Ace. Redwood Ace, they were on the 10th floor, I think they were. Opposite the Manford. And then obviously when my mum and dad had the third one, the brother, we moved to a house on the bend, 4th drive on Chelmsy Wood, round corner from Ascent. So there, went to Bishop Wilson School, and then from then went to Grimshaw, loved football, played football any given time. You know, you used to walk around your mates, 1 minute to be 4, the next minute 22 aside. It touched the ball probably what, twice, because you're the smaller ones and the older ones playing. You know, obviously, you know, you're top banner for whatever. Sometimes as you got a bit older, somebody would bring the radio out and we'd have and all that sort of stuff going on. And loved fishing as a kid. My dad's well, I still fish now, but my dad's big fisherman, taught me how to fish down the River Cole, bamboo stick, you know, huckleberry fin style, bill of line, matchstick, catching sticklebacks. We used to, sometimes it sounds a bit moody, we used to swim
in the River Cole.
In the Cole.
Avoiding the trolleys.
over the trolleys. We used to Kings's Lake as well. My dad almost taught us how to swim Kings's Lake. That's ridiculous, eyes. Mm-hmm. I was in the early 80s. That's ridiculous. I was just Northwood Sports Centre. I did a bit of boxing over there when I was a kid. I went to Cubs.
Did you play for Grimshaw, Sam?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
it was Conway.
No.
It was a ditch
now. So we had Mr. Davies, yeah. Mr. Adams,
yeah.
And Mr. Bird. Now, Mr. Bird was the ultimate PE teacher. He was overweight. He wore tracksuit all the time. Used to smoke constantly. Did you know what I mean?
And like someone you'd look up to.
To look up to aspire to. I remember I was like mustard and running at school. Football and running, I was like, you know, I think I played left back for school. We won loads of trophies. We played at Coventry, we played at, you know, all these different stadiums and stuff. Because Grimshaw, we were good football, yeah,
because that's all we did. Yeah. I think that computer, I said, boot the ball, just carry a ball around, we'll follow him on. You always find a Kayser, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Kayser and a couple of pages from a porno you find.
Basically, yeah, you go a little
sad space. You're thinking, wow, whoa.
Yeah.
I'll just use the
ball. Like, yeah, I'll just have the ball. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, but I was like, I represented England in the under 16s cross country team. And I loved running. And Mr. Bird was standing. So I had the school record, which was like 4 minutes 30 something for the 1500 metres. And Mr. Bird would be standing there shouting at me. And the guy Ben walked 2 yards about blowing out his arse. Smoking. But anyway, yeah, so that. And that.
But Kez.
Yeah. Gaspar! Put out! Oh, the Brummie. Yeah. And that was. You know, growing up, and it was like, you know, I think we spoke earlier, it was like, you know, I'm not condoning, but if you ever had an issue or something, you might get a punch in the nose or wherever. And it was done, money. And that was the sort of bringing up of what it was. We never had much money, which most of us, we didn't anyway, because at that time in the 80s where it seemed like everyone was struggling. Mm-hmm. And food wasn't exactly massive and plentiful at home. So that's my love for food come from the way my mum would cook. And the way it was like totally respected. So
I had to get a bit inventive, didn't I, back in that?
Corn beef, potatoes.
Yeah, corn beef, potatoes, spam. I was talking about spam in the box actually, because one of the snacks we do
is
spam crisps.
Yeah.
And I remember scratching around in your pocket because I had the scap car loaded.
Yeah.
And my dad was in and out of work because obviously the factory one minute they're booming, next minute they're laying people off. And my dad worked in Metrocamel building trains and stuff. And we had to have the scaff card, and like you learned how to stick up for yourself. And now makes a little bit of a rumble with the scaff card because you used to queue separate. Scaff card. That's so. Remember the stupid scaff.
It was like you get this little piece of paper, didn't you? And you go up and you'd have extra amount. You could have extra amount on this card. People come up to you and hear the guy, your scav card, and all that sort of stuff. And then, yeah, you don't need the second or first year. Because by the time you got a third year, you really care anyway. Because as long as I'm getting fair, I'm bothered.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he'd go back outside, and then you'd have a football match, and then you'd be talking about scav card. And end up giving somebody a slap because somebody's taking a mick out of your scav card. But I used to say it was 11 pence it was for a spam and fritter. So sometimes I used to scratch around at home. You get 11 per, put it in there, have my scav card, and then have an extra spam for a set. So that was like charms.
You were what kind of system?
Well, it's haute cuisine, isn't it? The spam for a set. Not only is it hot tomorrow, though, you also get this gush of grease, which just goes straight over your chin.
Warm your face.
You warm your face. Fritter. Exactly. And like, so for me, something. So then that was the love for food, was like, and also you can never be late for dinner. You would never be late for dinner. And as you boys know, when the lights come on, it's time to come in. Your mum would stand at the end of the garden. She'd shout your name. If you couldn't hear her, somebody would hear you and go, oh, pal, your mum's calling you. And you're going for dinner. So my love for food was that the hub. It was like the hub. You know, when my dad come back from work and we all come back from school and stuff, we'd wait for my dad to come home and we'd all have dinner together, all six of us. And that was the sort of like the regalia of having dinner and, like you say, be creative with food. And that's what my love for food come from, that environment, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw in one of the interviews that you mentioned pig trotters.
Yeah, pig trotters.
Yeah. Our granddad used to ball the pig trotters. I'd never heard anyone else speak about it until I saw it in your interview.
Yeah. So we go to the market, at the Birmingham market, and I've got this big head bag all for Christmas. Right, you know the one you can zip the side off from as well?
Retro.
Yeah. Prop bag was, and it was like a grey, had like a purple sort of bag zip off. And when you got sort of called towards sort of fourth and fifth year, you'd take limited equipment, unless it was PE. So you'd have your little head bag, a ruler just fitting in there with like 2 pence and somewhere. You'd be walking in like that with the small bit of tie, which you didn't want to be.
Or tucked in
because there was two. And my mum and dad bought me this head bag for Christmas, and I was like buzzing, like, But he was massive, this bag was. And I realised what it was for. Every other weekend, I used to have to go to the Birmingham market, even though I'm on the 55 bus, to go and get the meat. So we'd go.
Half his size.
We'd go and like we'd be... And she always goes to the same bloke. And I did some filming, probably about 10 years ago, and I did some filming down there. And I still recognised the guy that used to serve Arrow later. Do you remember how he was? He just looked slightly weathered. Like, we're talking about them Stoke fans. He looked a bit weathered.
Yeah.
But, and he used to go to Salmon, because they have characters down there. But he know my mum come in every 2 weeks. You know that she's got a couple of quid in her purse. And he used to look after us. So he'd turn around and say, oh, yeah. And you open your bag up and he'd throw you like a little bag of pig's trotters.
Yeah.
So we'd have to normally eat whatever, chicken thighs and all that sort of stuff. Rabbit was the form we used to have. And he realised we were eating rabbit till probably two of my early teens. We used to have this rabbit stew and we used to have some chicken, but the rabbit was half a brass of chicken. Right. No one was pulling it. Wow. So we used to have this rabbit stew, which basically the recipe, just to put it out, so I had two or three shredded legs and an onion, all the rabbit legs in there, a cup of barley, fill it with water, lid on, salt, lid on, in the oven, just leave it. And it comes out like almost like a very liquid gold is. The stock, it's almost, it's clear. It's, and all the legs cook down and the rabbit falls off. It was delicious. So then my mum would get home and then my mum would put these pig trotters in the pressure cooker. Big fist of salt, crack it on, and you'd be like just steaming away for hours. And by the time you've had your dinner, it's time to get ready. So you go, have a wash, put your pyjamas on, come back downstairs, blind date starts.
Yep.
And then my mum brings out a small saucer with like a pig's foot boiled with a little bit of hair in between the toe.
I was the Tracy bit.
That was me, like, and you pick it up, or you put a little bit of salt or a little splash of vinegar over it, and then all the stickiness will go down your arms and stuff.
And I was telling Ronan Keating, he's on Saturday Kitchens, and he's looking at me and I said, Ronan, you can't tell me when you used to say that you wake up with crusty pyjamas. He looked at me and just slightly moved away.
So come on, Ronan.
Come on,
it's a roller coaster, kids.
This is all the way at my mum's from.
Was that live, was right?
My mum's from Warnden in Worcester, and she met my dad because my mum's sister had married a Brummie, and then my mum used to come and see her sister, and then my dad saw my mum a few times, and he took her out on a date. He said something about curry. My mum from Warnden in Worcester, they didn't know what curry was. Do you know what I mean? No one did today apart from your, like, Birmingham and maybe a couple of little places up north, but mainly Birmingham that had that vibe. And my mum was like, ooh. And I just said, yeah, you want to try something a bit exotic? And I think that's what he meant with the curry, I think. That, or he's really strong after she. And he took her for a curry and she had an omelette.
Yeah.
She had an omelette. Yes, an omelette and chips on their first day, I think. Yeah. Brilliant.
Took her for English.
Yeah, he took her for English. And my mum used to have some, like with the rabbit and like being creative. Rabbit. It was almost fish roe. Right? Not roe out the tin, actual roe, because she'd get it for literally for pennies. So the fish roe, and it's like, if you ever seen fresh fish roe, it's really not that appealing to look at. And it's not
appealing in the tin, is it?
It's not really, but I'm not appealing full stop. Yeah. But my mum used to get it, and like, she used to cook some weird stuff that cost nothing. But everyone used to come around and ask him, what are you having for dinner, man?
And there's like strange stuff in the sink, like a fish roe soaking. And, well, she used to fry it. And like salt, pepper, fry it, a little bit of vinegar. And we used to have it with mashed potato or chips and peas, whatever. And it was like, what is that? And we used to smell of it for about 3 days. We never really seen meat. Quite good at fighting as well, because you smell like semen, yeah?
She left your coat in your kitchen by accident.
You're going out of this thing.
Right, I took my scrapping over everything. Someone's checking the piss out of your trainers. You have a scrap there. Next piece.
So cure bullets.
You got someone giving you some shit about smelling like fish, right? You give them a smack of all. You keep fucking out.
Not like your first break,
yeah? And you got the scat card, yeah. Scrapping away. Scat cards to come.
That's
normal. That was a minor thing. And it was like, but the bit that, so my dad, was obsessed with cooking as well. So my dad used to cook on the weekends. On the Saturday, my dad used to cook.
And he used to watch, we used to watch Food and Drink, Keith Floyd, Madame Jaffrey, Ken Hunt. And these were like, you know, these were, these were cooking stuff that, you know, normal just average Joe weren't really cooking, were they? Because he was like a very staple meat and two veg kind of people. This was, again, this is in the 80s,
yeah.
And my dad used to start writing the recipes down because obviously he couldn't go online because there was no internet.
Yes.
Imagine that, no internet. So my dad used to scratch it on the top of the newspaper and then he'd copy like Madame Jaffrey's sort of, he bought a spice rack, which a lot of people have still got that, have bought in the 80s that have never opened the spice
rack. Yeah, yeah. Did he actually use that spice rack?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
I'm sure it's the one that opened him along the lot.
Yeah, definitely.
Original five spice.
Yeah. But the people just have those decorations.
Yeah.
And my dad, and then my mates would come around and go, "Whoa, what are you having for your tea, dog?" And I said, "Robin curry, me dad's make curry, is it? I don't smell like my mum's curry." Now, most curry you had them days was home pride in the thing. You'd have a pineapple, sultanas, and just tasted awful. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But my dad was cooking it with tin tomatoes. He was getting the spices. He was like, you know, chopping all the onions down to garlic and all that.
What was your hate sultanas and curries?
I don't think actually, but I think
he might have a bit more chocolate proof.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a little water. Maybe a bowl of ice cream, you know, it's a buddy, isn't it? So, but it was just that sort of like culture of my dad wanted to cook, my mum cooking the staple stuff in the week, and then my dad would go off-piste, and he was a little bit more creative. Mm. We had a wok with it.
Yeah.
A big wok, and it was not all the trendy ones now, they've got a flat bottom on it.
Oh, yeah,
it was a wok, like the one that...
My handy one.
Yeah, yeah, and one if you cook CD and you left it, you just got luster.
Yeah.
So, mate,
you want to taste what you have the last minute on this minute.
I think so. And that tinge of rust as well. Yeah. That's going to haunt you in your 40s, isn't it? That is.
I'm a tailbone
maccas. So I got made a visiting professor at the UCB. And I got all the gang and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, this is great, do you know what I mean? And went and did it, and it was like a real champagne everywhere and all that sort of stuff. Afterwards, the dean of the university come up to me, dad, and I told this story about my dad cooking with a wok and more or less to you. And like the funny thing, with a little electric cooker, when you put the wok on the electric cooker, it just rolled off. So you couldn't leave, you had to stand in all it. Isn't far too big for the your brown bottom, she'd do a good angle. Bean sprouts all on the floor and that. Dogs, dogs
like that. Using the lock again.
The dog's full whack on it, like, and I was pissing the dog off, picking it back up. And so I told the dean of the university about my dad's, and he's come up to my dad and we're really posh and stuff. And mum and dad all got the best clothes on and that, like. And he said to me, he said, "Oh, Mr. Permanel, do you still have your, do you still have your wok?" The club was telling me about this. He said, "Do you use it?" "Yeah." "So I only use it to iron my shirts now." Just rubbed his belly. I was like, "God."
He did find it really amusing, but yeah, you find it really amusing.
Did you? Obviously, he was inspired then to become a chef. How's it all gone? How did it all start? How did you become such a...
So obviously you sit down with the careers officer and they look at you and they go, "Oh no, okay. Not really academic. Can't play an instrument." And you play up all the time. You never shut up. Well, what do you want to do? Oh, wow. I think I want to be a policeman. Then first. And then I realised maybe being a policeman, I charmed you would grow up with for the magazine.
And the bang of my semis.
Right.
Got the jam for it. Was in a sort of like a Swiss turn. They said the bloke after got scuba diver.
Really?
Yeah.
Scuba diver.
The landlocked Birmingham.
He said
it's scuba.
He's got to get himself out. So he said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I was like, I don't, you know. And I thought, then I'll do work experience. And I caught the wrong bus on more work experiences. So my mum gave me the money to
So the guy called Graham used to come into my mum's shop, because my mum used to work at Dillon's on Waterloo Avenue, which used to do the newspapers and stuff. And so I decided I was going to be a chef. So I needed work experience. I thought, I'll be a chef, let's try that, whatever. No qualifications necessary for, you know, I was a DC survey. So work experience, this guy used to go to the shop every day and used to say to him, talk to him about, and mum said, oh, can you get some work experience, Graham? You mean, yeah, he was working at the NEC. So so he said, yeah. So sorted all the, through the school and all that sort of stuff, got my work experience. Mum's written down on a piece of paper, you need to catch the 966 from the town centre, go there, speak to this person, they always were. I've gone there, got two early shop, charity shops. I call it the interchange now, just call it the back of the shop, sorry. So I stood there, and then the 73 bus come, I had NEC, I thought, wow, well, jump on this one, I'll get there early or not. Good impression that, yeah. So I jumped on it, went all the way around the Riki, with the 96 went straight there, straight back, so all around the Riki. And then I got to the NEC, and I was like, God, I said, you need to get off now, mate. At the end of the stop, you need to get off. I was like, where's the NEC? You know, he would go through there, over there, put it. Saw this big brand building. I thought, well, that looks like somewhere Alan John would play. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot of flamboyant. Well, I'll go there. So we've gone in, and this guy with a big hat on, long coat, opened the door for me. I was like, this doesn't look like the NEC. Brought in a massive chandelier. I recognised this dip. So I looked at this big chandelier. I thought, this is priceless. Polished marble floors. So I said, oh, I'm looking for personnel apartments. That's what it's called there. So go down there, turn around. Anyway, walk around, go in there. Got to the office. There was no Glimpernel on the list. I said, no. Graham goes from mum's shop. He saw a work experience there, or where. No, there's no Graham here. I rang around every kitchen. There's no Graham works here. I said, oh. But I sort of had a feeling inside that this is better than the NEC. And I was actually at the Metropop Hotel. It had Scotch Rice, I was going to say, yeah. And I was like, oh. I said to him, I said, oh, please don't send me back to school. I said, oh, can you not do work experience? And the woman was called Tina Morris. And I spoke to her recently, actually, on through social media. And she gave me a chance. She just sort of liked me. For he's cheeky, he's got a bit of fame, and she phoned school, sorted it out. So then from then I worked.
Oh, so you never went to the NEC?
You
got back through that?
Through that, yeah. I just pushed. I was like, oh, please don't send me back. I just thought I've had a good feeling. And the woman, Tina, was lovely. She was like, okay, just sit down there. Or they went and got me a cup of tea and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? It was like, and like, she gave me the opportunity, and that's why anybody ever knocks on my door for an opportunity, I give it to them, because I got my opportunity. And I've had lots of opportunities in the process of from when I am now all the way up, and I think it's paid back now.
Yeah.
So eventually I was working Friday and Saturdays and all that sort of stuff, and you know, halfway through football matches, you know, on the grass like and that, and they all go, oh, where are you off to, Penal? Hey, cooking, you're like a fucking dinner lady for all that sort of stuff. Because being a chef in 1988, it wasn't the most masculine job.
It was cool, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a lot.
Just what it was cool.
Yeah, but you'd be get tabard on all that sort of stuff. Go and get your apron on, like sort of stuff. And I was like, but then you know how to set the banter.
Five again.
Well, you know, you set the banter then, didn't you? Yeah. You wasn't getting up too upset because you're sort of being, and to be honest with you, a couple of them, I've come to the restaurant, a couple of lads who's talking about it, a bit older than me, I've come to the restaurant all to my pool or whatever and said, look, you know, I just always had the piss out of you cooking. I said, but now I try to, he says to me, now I try this big hard ladders, now I cook at home myself and I love going to restaurants. So they sort of appreciate it now. Yeah. But then from then on, I just sort of like, I just dedicated everything to cooking. I used to play football on Sundays and stuff. He's playing Saturday League as well, so I gave up the Saturday League so that I could cook. And then I was fishing a lot later now, so I sort of give up Sunday football for a little bit and then I went back to it. But you know, I got to a stage where I was winning sort of competitions, cookery competitions and stuff, and then I sort of thought I needed to better myself. I knew I wanted to always better myself, so I wrote a letter to Gary Rokes and employed. I did 2 weeks down there. But London, because I was only 18, and I just didn't like the mentality of the people, because it's so busy. And like, you know, when you go into the centre of Birmingham, you feel, because it's home, isn't it? So you feel like you're at home, don't you? So so I remember coming out of Euston Station, holding the door open for somebody. I must have been there for about 5 minutes. So people just kept coming around thinking, I didn't want to let the door go.
I was just not to pack you.
No, I was just too polite. I was like, and I thought, I don't have to, I just let it go and then walk off. Because I was like a fucking concierge. You know what I mean? So I stayed there. I stayed, you know, like a D&D, and he was just like, food was great. He was great. God rest him, he's passed now, but he was great, and the food was great, and he was just infused me more. And then I went to work at Simpsons when it was in Kenilworth. When I worked for Simpsons, I sort of saved my money, and again, I did stashes. So I did a couple of weeks with Gordon Ramsay. Which, to be fair, some of the best food I've ever seen, and some of the most entertaining and serves I've ever seen.
This is one of the things I wanted to ask you. Yeah. Is it all a facade? Celebrity TV chefs, everyone's constantly getting rollicked. It seems like the atmosphere you could cut with a knot. Is that the given? Is that what a kitchen is, that everyone's essentially scared witless of the head chef?
Years ago it was. When I say years ago, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago. Now, times have massively changed, and you know, it'll go over. No, but thankfully it hasn't, because obviously, you know, I always say for lads, you know, don't get wrong, when I was a bit younger, I had a bit better than edge to me, and you know, you, because of the mentality, the way of you've been brought up into a kitchen, you feel boiled, you know, running the kitchen, you know, with this sort of almost fear atmosphere. It's a right thing to do, because after all, you were brought up in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know, you think twice, you get punched in the chest or kicked in the shit. When I was a commis chef, you know, so I'm 50 now, so that was like, I mean, I was like 14, 15. We were sort of like, you used to laugh it off anyway, because you used to, for half inside, you're laughing because it's funny, there's this big grown man spitting at you. And I kick it, you think, yeah. It's just peas, mate. You do what I mean? Because you don't understand it, sort of it.
And then you get to the office and you're like, peas.
You already fucking peas, but for me, like, I think quite a few chefs of my generation realise that isn't going to work. It's not the right environment. You know, you need to, because everyone's so passionate about what they do, especially in the levels that we were cooking at. It's like, it's about control, it being a bit more thoughtful, being more organized, whatever. And it was almost like trying to be rock and roll stars in the 90s, because that's what it had, that sort of vibe to it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, tattoos, beards, all that sort of drafted in and stuff. But for me, I always say to my pets, if you're going to have your kidney removed by a surgeon, would you want him shouting, swearing, kicking stuff, and you know, whatever? Because he needs to be calm, needs to be precise, and that sort of stuff. So that sort of bred more into what's happening now. But it was a very volatile environment, definitely. And, you know, I mean, lots of chefs from a Bernie Inn right the way up until sort of like, you know, fine line restaurants would have had it, experienced it. You know, it's like, it's acceptable in the kitchen, but not acceptable in any other part of the world.
If you was in an office and you behaved like a chef behaves in the mid-90s, and said to it, "Hey, you, pass me that fucking stapler before I smash it." It doesn't work, does it? So that's changed us, and it's changed for the better. So it's more of a thinking chef's game, more of a, you know, being more of a...
the employer, I reckon, than saying around staff is going to box, yeah, isn't it? Well, you want to look after you.
We had just have a... my staff at Parnell's, before we shut, I had one person was there for... a couple of people there for 5 or 6 years. I had a head chef was there for 12 years. The two head chef, one was there for 12 years, one was there for 10 years. My previous head chef for that was there for 13 years. So I've always tried to treat them like I would want to be treated. But also, when you become a dad and all the rest of it, you want some big, hairy ass bloke, you know, knocking your kid about, do you? Mm. So you have to, you know, and I just see...
From your part of view then, you want it low maintenance, that you can rely on these guys, and you don't want to... You just want to talk to them like they're... mates and colleagues and what,
yeah. So to breed that culture of just good well-being, and you know, and like you said, you know, the turnover, if we were swapping a chef every 10 minutes because you can't control his temper, I mean,
there's a problem.
Yeah, you wouldn't be doing the piece yourself, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. 10
and better yourself.
Please.
For your tips there on life and Jessica's.
Yes.
So this is where you, am I right, the first Michelin star, Birmingham.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, so I was working at Simpsons, and then from Simpsons I went to work for this French guy called Claude Bozy, who's just had towards, who's in Ludlow. So I worked, I was only there for about 6-7 months, and it was more of like almost like a finishing kitchen for me. So I worked with this guy, French, was the first ever English sous chef. We went from 1 star to 2 stars, so I was part of that little team that did that. And now I thought it's time for me to try and do something myself, and a few job offers in London and stuff. But I wanted to make Birmingham a culinary place to go. I wanted to do it here. And previously, Birmingham has always been knocked as like this culinary desert, and it's a shithole and all that sort of stuff. And at that time, the Boring was just being built. The new Boring was being built. So I felt that it was the right time to do something in Birmingham. And I don't get me wrong, I was on the right off the beaten track. I was just off the Aggie Road. And I went to see the restaurant in the daytime. I never went to nighttime, right? So then the opening night was, we had about 20 odd books. And then I went outside, there was cars everywhere. I thought, we're going to smash it down. It was so busy. And realised it was a peak red light district.
Literally. Mm-hmm. Literally. There was more Johnnies on the floor than fucking leaves.
Do you know what I mean? So I remember my first ever review was on the What's on magazine or something like that. Yeah, it was on that. And the title was Jessica's The Lady of the Night. That was the title of the thing. Yeah, it was a great review. Something like, yeah, it was a great review.
Just had a little nod towards where it was.
To where it was, yeah. And then like, you know, we had a few experiences of you know, the girls coming into the thing and all that sort of stuff.
I was going to say, did you pick up any trade from the...
From the punters? Yeah, I tried to get them before with a few more grin in the pocket, but I don't know, they're a bit more zesty. Afterwards, they were flagging
the skeets. Not beats, did they? What's half of the food?
They're flagging the skeets, so... Yeah. And those spinal cords are down. But again, I worked with the police, and we sort of cleaned the area up a little bit with the residents as well and stuff. And we cleaned the area up, and we was there for about 4 years, and I just got to the point, I had a business partner. And I just thought to myself, my dream was to always do it myself and have my name above the door, although everyone knew who I was at Jessica's. But and I thought, this is it, I'm going to do it. I just had my first son. There was 2, I think, and... I said to Palmer at the time, I said, we're going to take the money out of the house and then buy a restaurant, buy a building, or, you know, rent a building and stuff. And I did it on a massive shoestring, so I had X amount of money from the house. I took out a loan, then I took out another loan on the back of the loan, and then I took a few credit cards out and just sort of long windy. And it sort of just, I found it intact, the site intact, and I just went for it. And then we got star the first year we opened there. We won AI Restaurant of the Year. And then I had a phone call off one of our nights, sat by and saying, somebody wants to talk to you about doing some TV. At the time, because I felt I was a bit rock and roll and a bit sort of like, I don't do TV. I was like, you know, I don't do TV. I'm a chef in the kitchen over. But eventually he convinced me to do The Great Rich Men. And then did a Great Rich Menu, and
TV just
again. Yeah, TV just followed after that. So with the Great Rich Menu, with honeymoon period, I'd already filmed the Great Rich Menu. The honeymoon period was wearing off at the restaurants, and we just in 2008 we had the property collapse,
the
property market collapse.
Yep.
It was like they call it the credit crunch, didn't they? Yeah, sort of stuff. All of a sudden, the restaurant was empty, and I was like, "Fucking hell." And also, I personally guaranteed to this. So I lost my house. Well, I didn't have much in anyway because I took most of it out. Well, but, you know, I said I had to do it. And my other half was pregnant with my daughter. So I had a son. And then from January, February, it was really, really, really quiet to the point where I think I might have to let some people go. And then the program landed in March and we were fully booked for 2 years.
just like, and he just was ridiculous, like interviews, paper, a newspaper, film magazines, and that's when I got called the Yummy Premieres.
Yeah.
So the Yummy Premier had an article in the Olive, BBC Olive magazine. Because people think I call it myself.
We were wondering if you was like a Tinder profile back in the day or something.
No,
Tinder for chefs.
Yeah, you said, when you look this good, you don't need to call me.
What's wrong with you?
So it was like, I people say that I call myself the Prince of Birmingham. And people have called me that. Do you know what I mean? And people can argue whatever they want, but that's the fact. So the title was the Yummy Brummy. And there was an article about me, and there was an article about five or six different places in Birmingham. And that's when the media sort of really picked up on it. And like, obviously Birmingham, because it was in the second city, and we've never really been sort of like celebrated.
Yeah.
Any opportunity to stick the boot in at Birmingham, they used to do it. Not so much now, but they used to. And like, I got a lot of attention off the back of the fact that Birmingham was renowned as this culinary desert that you couldn't get a decent meal. All of a sudden, you know, it sort of ignited a food culture where people felt confidence to open places. And from, you know, from the street food, which had obviously exploded over the years, you know, we've had the culture of the Baltic Triangle and all that stuff, but all of a sudden Birmingham was noticed as a food destination. But it wasn't just curry.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because sometimes that still does upset me a little bit when, like, an international journalist comes or a national journalist comes and they come and they just focus on that.
Yes,
it's great, but we are more than that now.
Yeah.
There's so much more.
The Birmingham Post once called you undoubtedly the finest chef to hail from Challengely Wood.
Were you aware there was competition or
just that old lady?
Would you agree with that?
She was wounded.
Yeah, when they went to me with that comment, what are you off? What are you on about? Have you ever been to Challengely Wood? It's not saying that, there was another kid, Rob Palmer. I think he's from the Pasha side of Challengely Wood. I think you saw that grey area between Marston Green and
that's all.
Yeah, it's a grey area of. Is it challenging, isn't it? I think he won a mission as that. So yeah, maybe, yeah. I mean, I'll say, anybody says you're the best of anything, Jeremy. So literally, I'm the best chef in this room now, aren't
I? They didn't need to close it down to challenging.
But I mean, you know, they could have been a bit more generous. And said North Solihull. West Midlands.
Yeah, North Solihull. There's somewhere absolutely nine in it to say Solihull. But yeah,
North Solihull. North Solihull.
No, I'm touchable right there. We spoke to Carl Shin recently about accents and colloquialism, and
yeah,
you'll find that's been a bit of a stumbling block for you, or not really?
Not really.
What about work? Your worst showing? Yeah, say on something. Was that part of your persona that was a plus for you more than he was saying? He'd have executives, normally London executives, telling to tone down, saying the exact right of the accent for effects, and can you take it down a notch?
I think the thing with TV is I've always. You have to be exactly this. If you want to do TV, you want to be in the public eye, you've got to be the same all of the time. So there's no good you like trying to, you know, give off this different persona when you're in front of the screen and then go back, whatever. So I've always embraced the fact that I've got this accent. But the thing is, when you're on TV, you're the only Brummie on TV surrounded by, you know,
non-regional dialects.
Yeah.
A telephone boy sound bit.
Yeah. But you stand out more, so you go, whoa, his accent's strong, isn't he? No, it's only because I'm surrounded by... So we don't sound like we've got accent there, do we?
No.
Because we're all the same, aren't we? But when you put, like, on the screen, you're surrounded by sort of, like, generic sort of accents, you sound like, literally, you've just come, you know, you've just come straight out of the ballroom with your pig's feathers, do you know what I mean? With your flat cap on. He's a selling the leather door.
And recording, mate, accentuates it.
Oh, yeah, even more. When I first did Tinder, I could stand the way I sounded. But I thought, well, that's the way you sound, so what are you going to do about it? And I never used to. And to be fair, when Birmingham really started to come on the map, people loved the fact that you sounded like it. So a lot of TV, you know, from me do lots of TV programs, they quite like the fact that I sound like I sound. So,
yeah.
Mm. I think it's
great. Celebrate.
I think so, yeah. I mean, we are a little bit tight with our words. We like to hold on to as long as possible, don't we?
Sorry, not even on case, isn't
it? Yeah, we just dragged out a bit. But that, yeah. Well, what does upset me is when people say that they call you a yang-yang.
Dudley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, only Yan Yan. And like people from Dudley down in the corner of Brummie do that. But the rest of the country, I think we're the same.
Very bare, very lazy German organisation. It does produce sometimes. If like someone from Newcastle and Sunderland are a bit like that, Bowman lot.
Yeah.
Someone from the Wirral or from Liverpool. Oh, no, we're not Scousers. We're from the Wirral. I've got
no,
it's a Liverpool one. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's probably been those little battles going all over the country.
Where like...
Yeah, I mean, I love you, Mams. Yeah. But I ain't one.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I mean, I do love him. I think everyone should have one.
Yeah.
And they're not just for Christmas.
You have a leg on Boxing Day.
So, another string to your bow.
Yeah.
You're a published author.
Yeah.
Children's books. How did that come about? I assume having children played a part in that.
Having children, and I probably did a fair whack of drugs in the 90s, if I'm honest.
You finally got to express that in.
It's up to myself. These flashbacks, I need to put them into some sort of work here. I did enjoy the 90s. I think we all did.
Yeah.
So I've always. So when my kids were little, I used to watch The Bedtime Hour.
And for me, the bedtime, especially on Monday, because I never work till Monday, bedtime, I used to like tell the lights down, get more in their pyjamas, and I used to lie there and you watch all the little cartoons. Then you have the little story, and they'd like a famous actor or a famous actress or whatever would read the story. Like Tom Hardy studying.
No,
this is your sound now.
Yeah, this is it.
All the elements.
I'd love to do it. And, so, and then my kids used to say, can you tell me a story? We go to bed. And I used to make up stories. And then the following night, they'd say, tell us that story again. So last night, I was thinking, well, I can't remember what it was. So I used to make it up. But I've always wanted to write kids' books. And then my dog.
I used to have a dog called Whoops. She was a Jack Russell. And this is when I was at Jessica's. I used to take her to the restaurant every day. Right? So I used to have this big clapped out... Land Rover Discovery, which I don't know, I used to pass it somewhere, so but it used to scrape for every time I do anything. And you used to be able to drive it into the city centre, you can't now because you'll get shot from some sort of voice, a rifle to it, like, you know what I mean? You know how deep.
Yeah.
Forget about the aeroplanes, but just don't drive the car.
The emissions with CNO.
Yeah, done that.
And so I used to take her to work with me and whatever, and she was a run to the litter, and I used to tackle everywhere I went and stuff, and a little bit like Rick Stein, like a poor man's Rick Stein was. So, you know, walking down the canals rather than in front of the sea, whatever. And the one day, my daughter, and by this time the dog got old, almost like a barrel on necks, a great face, come walking past in the kitchen at home, and my daughter said, oh, Daddy's Whoops gonna die. And I looked and I thought, said, not for a while. And she was like, I thought this is
going to, the clock is ticking to
you. So I thought to myself, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a story about their dog to immortalise their first pet. So I wrote a story about a dog that eats baked beans and curry powder, which is the first dish I ever cooked for my sister when we were kids. Baked beans and curry powder, and she eats the beans and farts to fight crime. That's the whole premise of the story. So I wrote that. I enjoyed the process of it. Got a local illustrator who's doing it, Ashley. Lovely guy, very, very talented. I wanted somebody as local as possible. So he illustrated it, and then, you know, we got it published, and he got it, and it was really successful. And I did another one about an alpaca called Arnold, who was bullied because he had like a long nose and
booked his gap guard.
Yeah, he was based on the scab card, but he went the other route. He didn't try and batter him. He tried to go around the other way. So so all the sheep used to pick on him because the short-sighted farmer bought Arnold, thinking he was a sheep for his wool farm. And then all the sheep picked on him, so the long neck and buck teeth and all the rest of it. The two sheep they used to pick on him the worst, one was called Cutbits and the other one was called Shank, which I actually had two cuts of meat.
Awesome.
And in
all at the moment,
yeah, do a little, yeah. One had an earring, you know, thinking a bit like me. And I wrote that book, and that was successful, and I just enjoyed the process. And I think sometimes in life we all say we're going to do something or we all want to do something, but we're not brave enough to do it. Do you know what I mean?
And I so I was used to do that, Albert. Born and what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? Do it.
I know, can't ask you to do it for you, Honor.
No, no, I could have said, oh, I'd love to go scuba diving because it was the second job on my.
You must speak to that. I'm saying crazy.
It was the second job after policeman. You know, do it. Do it because life is far too short, but also far too boring not to do it. And I sort of, you know, I had a few contacts and stuff, so, you know, but I still had to do it. I still had to physically do it. So I had to go out there and do it. So I did the books. I've written three cookery books as well. So one probably about 2 or 3 years ago now. And that's just the whole journey of Pernell's. It's called The Journey There and Back Again. So it's like how it started and all the staff are in there. You've got some great pictures of the blue. It's almost like an autobiography, but it's sort of like with recipes in as well. So I wrote that as well. So yeah, but the kids' book was something I really wanted to do. So,
before we got to the blues,
yeah,
can we just touch upon what we were speaking about beforehand and the sad fact that you had to close the restaurant?
Yeah,
the vouchers.
Yeah, so I had Pernell's was 17. I did 17 years, and 15 great years. COVID. You had COVID, you had Brexit, we had all and it's and pieces thrown in. To have a restaurant for that long, he's at that sort of level. He, you know, I didn't realise the achievement until now, the justice settled. And you sort of look and you go, that was good, that was. Because most restaurants' lifespan's normally about 3 to 4 years. Is that what it is? Yeah, not bad. And the current climate, probably less. Well, there's probably not enough stupid people to open one, probably. So obviously, you know, always kept up on top of stuff, and then trade was very consistent, and then the wage bill was going up, the site was getting too big for what we were doing, demand was still there, but there's lots more competition and all that sort of stuff, and it just come to a point where I was losing money and I thought, do you know what, I've got to make a head over heart decision. I looked at the forecast of business, I looked at what was coming up, and I thought, I'm draining now, we're putting more money in them. I'd already put loads of now money in and I've lost most of that as well. So I thought to myself, I've got to make a decision, I've got to shut it.
So, sorry, is it because of the fine dining you do as well and the expense of the ingredients that you've got?
Yeah.
You've got to have it to serve. And there seems some, again, people on probably online, oh, it's so expensive or whatever the same. But I imagine that's, you have to, there's a trade-off between getting the ingredients and what you can charge and stuff and being.
Quite able to compromise the quality.
Yeah, exactly, and also you need the staff levels to keep that standard up. And I took the staff level down a little bit.
The awful thing about when you put a company into, you know, where it goes under, was such, you know, there's obviously bills and debts that need paying off and stuff. And then you get the liquidator in and administrator, liquidator, whatever they call it, and whatever. And then the voucher thing come up, and I was unaware that there was that many vouchers, but honestly. Because it's not something I would go down to the office and say, oh, Andy Bacher is sold. And then so that really sort of put me back. And in the meantime, my dad had just passed away as well. So my dad passed away, I think, a couple of weeks before I shut the restaurant. So I'd say possibly it's been the darkest part of my life. And I'm a positive kind of guy, do you know what I mean? I never let anything get me down. So then I'm getting bombarded, you know, and the odd iron abuse. Yeah, online abuse. And I totally understand. I can appreciate, you know, the people are frustrated and whatever and whatever. And then, you know, by the time I could get myself settled to then try and realise what I could do, because maybe I didn't really have to do anything, really. I could have just sat around and said, well, company's gone under. You know, I doubt that the CEO of Debenhams was getting personal abuse when they flipped Debenhams. But, you know, there was people out there that genuinely like understand it is what it is.
Well, it's the people that are abusing you, and like we said just before we come on, that are like, you're like, you got a voucher, what are
you messaging? Oh, yes, that's what we're talking about. So the one got a message me saying, oh, you should pay your voucher back. I said, have you got a voucher? And he went, no. I said, well, then fuck off then. Do you know what I mean? Don't abuse me. So you wouldn't do it to me if you see me in the street. Do you know what I mean? 6 for 1 off the woods. You ain't going to do it, are you?
Mm.
So fuck off. Mm. So then what I have done in the meantime, I've got everyone to send in their voucher or their whatever. I have done different packages and deals. Some people have got a book or a bottle of champagne, which we do our own champagne. Some people have got like a smaller menu at the tapas bar. Some people have got a bigger menu. Some people have got wine to go with it. Some people. So I am trawling through it.
Well, again, that shows what your a bit of your metal really to say, all right, well, I'm going to go back to this. It doesn't sit well with me or whatever, okay. Regardless of the, yeah. I mean, your restaurant's just going to answer your life.
Right. Yeah, I'm never.
I've done it just to do you over on your vouchers.
Exactly, I've lost like hundreds of thousands of pounds. If I'm genuinely honest with you, yeah, I've lost a lot of money, and people turn around and say, "I'm a tabby, he's a millionaire," but I'm a sole trader. I'm an independent businessman, and you know, to get to the position I've had, I've had to sacrifice and put loads of my time, finances through a
life.
So we're at a place now where I feel that most of the people have been satisfied with me doing that. But the thing that pisses you off is that it's on BBC News, it's on this, it's on that. They're not covering the fact that I've sorted it out, have they? There's been a couple of articles and stuff, but realistically, the BBC should, especially Midlands Today, they should do cover that story to say
they're doing this side, you've got to be doing that.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of coverage, wasn't there?
The great thing about being successful is you're successful, you get known. But as soon as someone is successful or that's known or renowned, it hits a bump.
Doom mongering. As soon as a bump in the road, then everybody's there and this, it can be a bit sad, this country, the way that sort of happens. But you've got to know how to hold it, and I always kept myself real grounded, and I can only do what I can do.
True to myself.
Yeah, and I don't, it's difficult not to take things too personally, but yeah. You know what I'm saying.
Yes.
You're going to get
people like that. Yeah, but like you say, we said before, and people have forgot what it's like to get slapped in the mouth sometimes. They're on the end of it. And going back to that Tony Bellew one,
yeah. Well, would you say that to me in the street? No, I wouldn't. That's what I'd say. That's what I'm
saying. Getting abused but having a bit of banter. I went blues with Coventry away a few years ago. That's fucking so funny. So we're all queuing up for food. Right. And to be fair, the Rico, they've got beer taps everywhere. So it's quite the way that they do, because it's obviously more of a modern ground than in the lockdowns. And somebody farted. You know, there's like loads of like middle-aged blokes that have had farting, which the drinker reality approached their pipe. Somebody's dropped the bat, or proper, and it fucking stone crop. And then everyone's going, "Oh, who done that?" And then this one guy's gone, "Oh, it's the chef with all that rich fucking food." I was crying, and the whole of the away end that were crammed into this small area were just crying with laughter. I swear to God, it was hilarious. So sometimes you get a bit of abuse, but then sometimes you get a little bit of sting.
So just
to
confirm, it wasn't you.
No, it wasn't me, no.
Is this like a massive fucking
attack? No, I'm really, really sorry. No, it wasn't.
I'm really, really sorry it was. Probably
because where they did it, needs
it's
to get
still out there.
No, they need to get themselves down to I need because they ain't fucking right now. Do you know what I mean?
They're not still right on appeal now. Whoever's out, you're still out there.
Please do not approach them. Because I think you're always water and you've been throwing up. It was just one of the funniest things that all my mates were crying.
Oh, proper crying.
So you do get it. I mean, you have to get used to that abuse, but sometimes, like I said, I messaged that one girl back and said to him, "Book, yeah, do what? Because you're being silly now because it's got nothing to do with you." And then you'll get the Coventry thing and you'll get people, you know, will shout down the streets and stuff like that. So sometimes I have to be careful when I go to the supermarket and stuff and watch what I put in my pocket because it's under a magnifying glass, honestly. Right, so...
But you get that job, people, on a little prod.
Oh, yeah. Well, my kids used to love. So I can make the best Yorkshire pudding ever. I can make it about this size, this big, like that, because that's what I do for a living, right? My kids got, like, when they were little, got a taste for those, you know, the little bought, you know, already made ones.
The ones that never rise properly in the tray.
Old Aunt Bessie's.
Yeah, the Aunt Bessie's or even the whole brand ones. Yes. And then we used to fill it with mash, a bit of cheese, and then stick a sausage in it. I can use the bacon for the kids, right? So I got a bag of them in my shopping. And then somebody rang free radio. I said, "I've just seen Glyn Pennell
It was like, you know, like a phone in. Oh, have you ever seen this? What's the funniest thing you've seen a celebrity do or whatever?
Yeah.
So I'll just see
shit's boss, whatever.
Yeah, I'll just sort of glimper now, buying ready my fucking Yorkshire puddings. Fucking hell, the shit I got.
Get lost.
Oh, man, it was on the radio all week. The whole week till at the end on the Friday.
People pickers in outside, right?
So everyone was just ripping it, like, and I was going. Anyway, so in the end, and there was all this thing on Twitter going on as well. And everyone was sending pictures of their Yorkshire puddings, and giving him the fucking recipe, all this sort of stuff, which is hilarious. But so then I made one, like, you know, this, about this big, and I'll put a picture on it, put it on, look, that's it. And it was really funny. I went in the studio and I spoke to the I can't remember the DJ's name. There was the two lads, and then one of them went off to the BBC. But yeah, I mean, that was great. But sometimes I get people come to me and I go, got this piece of pork, Glenn. What should I do with it? I must have some bring here. Hang on there. And I say a few words and I say, turn it up the other way. The cooking instructions from the back.
Because they generally are like that.
So if you get that lot, people want cooking box.
Yeah, you'll get people come to you and say, like, no, I got this, kind of, what should I do with this, kind of, this, and you go, yeah, and you just sort of like,
if you want,
yeah, if you want, yeah, and then you'll get like a selfie in the bean aisle. You say like, kind of, it's taken, or you'll be halfway through putting your shopping away. Because the other thing that makes me laugh, people go, what are you doing here? One, I need Rosh Nambiku. Two, we need toilet roll, because we do have to wipe our arses as well.
Really, it's just a shop where only, like, you know, people that have been,
you farm it all yourself.
Yeah, it's all like,
I open the fridge and there's a cow in there, and I just like milk the cow and just like pour it into me too. So it's just funny. What are you doing? You don't shop here. Which Morrison's? They mean, it's close.
There are the supermarkets available.
There are, yeah, there are. Sometimes I drop into Asda, Aldi's one. But I don't buy a lot in Aldi because I
get your lawnmowers and
your lawnmowers, your fishy trousers and maybe some kids' toys, and I might pick up a bottle of milk. I like Aldi. I don't go in there so much because the people that are trained to put the shopping for an Aldi, they're on fire, aren't they?
Yeah.
They think, I'm going to put the shopping through so fast. Right, he's going to be in the shitties.
Is he in the Yorkshire puddings? Are going to be everywhere.
Yeah, he's going to be everywhere. The bag's going to go like, fucking. And Sicky, man.
It's that whole multiple bags, don't you?
Yeah, so I sort of been at a back off for a big shop at Aldo. But I'll tell you what I do get from Aldo is the wine selection's really good. There's a bottle of Rioja, white Rioja in there, and it's about £4.50. And it's a great bottle of wine.
For cooking, I understand.
For drinking, babbling. Yep. A nice little glass of so you can, if you, and there's a nice bottle of red burgundy in there as well, 2017-18, and that's about £9. So you can get some good wine out of it. Yeah. So supermarkets, I do get that attention where people come out to me. Sometimes kids will be like, "Oh, don't go to shop, Dad. It's just like 200 people towards here," which is nice because generally, I don't think I've ever had anybody come up to me and have been rude. Most people, Brummies, come to me and go, "Hey, Glenn, you're all doing. Hey, Glenn, you're all doing. Oh, up the blues." Or even if you get the Villa fan, they go, they come to your shaker and they go, "Up the Villa." Do you know what I mean? Then you spot, you're right. Yes.
Could you do that back?
Yeah, you can. And just the talk of the supermarket, there's a joke in there. It's like, I don't go to the doctors, and the doctor says, what's the matter? I don't feel very well. Doctor, what's your name? He says, I feel a bit strange. I feel a little bit, I feel like a supermarket. He said, "Well, how long have you felt like that?" He said, "Ever since I've been little."
So poor, isn't it? But this is the stage we're at.
Yeah.
You like that?
I'm a bit like, I'm not going to use it.
Oh, of course you are. I don't think you are. Are you?
Not now.
Yeah, of course you are.
We are 5-year-old, 7-year-old, and 12-year-old.
He's trying to make it casual, but you think you steal it.
That's gold, that is. Yeah. At least about a couple of scoops, you know, down the rooster, and you start coming out. Yeah. That's what you want. Yeah, so supermarkets is a hot spot. And anywhere that's got food connected, you get more recognised.
Like, so for instance, like if you go to a restaurant, you'll get more recognised. Someone's on your walk down the street, no one knows who you are.
You're snobbing restaurants now.
Oh, unbelievable.
My dad. Just go in and they're like,
is like, make sure we've got the head chef on.
I'll bring out a wind machine when I come in, something like that.
Long coat
like that. What, Neo? Fucking Neo when I come to the restaurant. Tell the chef I've arrived.
Obviously, you're biased towards your own restaurants and place. Mm. But where would you recommend, or what's a particular favourite of yours in Birmingham? It's just quite a few restaurants, isn't there?
Yeah, obviously all the big guns are good. You know, I went to Ophim just after Christmas. Phenomenal. 2 Michelin stars. Indian, creative. Akhtar's a great friend of mine. And the food is phenomenal. So I'd say that's probably Birmingham at the minute. That restaurant's on fire. He's just a nice refurb and stuff. And I've got a lot of time for him. Known him for many, many years. That was phenomenal. And then I used to go to two Asian one Malaysian restaurant, and just by the Hippodrome. I don't know whether they've changed now. It's round the corner from Mr. Egg, where Mr. Egg was there. It's round the corner. There was two there. And sometimes if I was stuck in town or whatever, I'd go and just have Hong Kong duck or a big piece of pork pie, like some noodles. And that was pretty chippy, cheerful. There's, when you go in there and there's you're in a Chinese restaurant and there's loads of Chinese people in there, you sort of think, well, this is yeah. Good.
I've got people that have worked for me that have done well. So I've got David Taylor, who's head chef for Grace and Savor, Hampton Manor. So he was with me for 10 years. So one of the guys that I trained. Craig Treadwell, who's got 670 grams. That's in Digbeth. That's a great restaurant.
Yeah, I've eaten there.
Yeah, and I've known Craig since he was... since he was little.
Yeah, because he's a local lad, isn't he?
Yeah, so I've, his uncle is one of my best friends, so there, that's great. There's so much choice now to sort of go to. There's a little past closer stop, Paul Street, can never remember its name. But the half, Molly, she goes there, she's a bit of a pasta fan, so there's loads of places now. Obviously, all the Michelin star restaurants you guarantee to, yeah, good mealy nose, but it's obviously cost and stuff. So
yeah.
And the street food, Parker Social, great. And Andy loves it. That full sort of, yeah. So there's loads of places, really.
Yeah.
What we haven't got is a really good fish and chip shop.
Yes, you go to Harry Ramsden's closed about 15 years ago, didn't he, on the Elfav Road?
Wouldn't run down as small as long ago. Faster.
Yeah, but in the Zeta, we've got a fish and chip shop. We've got burn place, you've got taco. Actually, I do like a nice burrito. The Western Arcade?
Yeah.
There's one in there, and it's so good. Like, when I say...
Oh, the Western Farm?
So the West Arcade, where by Snow Hill Station?
Yeah.
You've got all the little Victorian arcades. Mm. You go in there, from where the station is, about third shop in. The burritos and the tacos now are phenomenal. When I say that they're this big, the coat I've got now, I think there's a couple of scars down it from all the sauce in your body.
Wise after a few back in the day, you get a few scoops on Board Street, just demolished.
But there's a few, there's some really good places in Birmingham, and I just hope that a lot of them survive the tough time that's happening now. That's the only concern, because it'll put us back. What I've seen is a big influx of big chain restaurants coming into Birmingham again.
Yeah.
Which is difficult, because those are the guys that can afford and they can take the hits. As in they can afford to lose money for X amount of time, whereas an independent guy like myself or the guys, would you start getting that, then you funded it out.
It's most straight away before it starts.
Before you can get up. So there's a fair few chain restaurants, which, hopefully independents, and we start coming out the back end of what's happening, sir.
Yeah.
But there's some good places.
So we've got the sliding doors then, with this thing that's happened down the blues now, I assume you just wouldn't have had time to do it if you was there. So what would you have done, took it on? How did it come about?
You're right, yes. I mean, the time would have been difficult. So obviously now I've got the opportunity, I've got a bit more time. Still have got two other places.
Is Blues fan as well?
Massive Blues fan, yeah. We've had some tough times down here. We've had some great times as well. I've had some brilliant days out here. I remember one day, we were over in the corner. I think we drew 1-1 against Middlesbrough. And I was in my early 20s. And it was just like, we went out at 11 o'clock. And we didn't come back until Monday. But man, it was a ball and draw. Do you imagine if we'd have won? Dimbe Adebola came on a sub. Trevor Fancy bought him, came on a sub. And because Big D's legs were that big, you had to cut the side of his shorts to get them on. They didn't take into equation when they bought the 6'4", 18 stone striker, who he might need the bigger shorts. they had to cut his shorts.
Well, the irony is, in the '90s, all the kits were oversized.
Yeah, but it was just like, I just stuck him on the line. He just cut the shorts. But yeah, massive Blues fan. I had the opportunity to come and work at the club, so I've got to know Stephen Knight over the years. Absolute gentleman, massive Blues fan as well. Loves coming down here, gets really upset when we lose, like really upset. I seen him over Christmas and coming, he was going, oh, it's ruined my life. And then we truly gets blacked all it, mate.
Just a bit. Yeah, it's awful. Will you fast forward from last Boxing Day? And it's night and day, isn't it, in regards to where we are?
Massive. Thankfully. And then so then we got chatting together, and
I know Stephen and Gary Cook had decided I wanted to do the Garrison, and then Stephen said, well, let's get clean into the food. And then we got to that sort of stage, and then I sort of helped him out a little bit with 12, the concept with that, with John T, who's running that bit and stuff and that. And then they asked me the right to do like a residency at the boardroom. So I thought, I said, yeah, let's do it. And then we sort of went in, contacted a good friend of mine, Tim, who's got an art gallery, so he's put some artwork up in there.
Is that the art that's now showing the way up to the Garrison?
Yeah. Landing. It's just got like iconic streets of Birmingham. It's done by Brummy Paint, local painters as well. And there's a couple of the grounds, there's a couple of sort of the six central.
Yeah.
And you can, some of them are prints, some of them are originals, but you can get the details if you want to buy it, you can buy it. So there's opportunity to take a little bit of that home as well. We did our first game, was Exeter. It went really well. So it was a good Saturday. It was really good. Yeah, it's good. Four courses, and we did all the theatre and stuff like that. Like, you're a little bit stressful, but yeah, the first one went really, really well.
Mm. So was it always in your aspirations to do something down there, or not as a kind of...
The good thing, I'm a little bit, I look back on my life sometimes, it's a little bit like Forrest Gump. I mean, I wasn't the world champion ping pong player, so I'm sure. But I did win the silver medal in the English Open kickboxing, can I just say.
And the brilliant.
Yeah, so I've had a sort of a Forrest Gump kind of quote of life. I haven't been shrimp fishing yet, but that's... Oh, I have actually been shrimp fishing, yeah. I did it on TV. Yeah, I did. I always thought, like I was saying to you before, if you want to do something...
And say you're going to do it, do it and enjoy it. I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to do something with Gary and Stephen, with the Garrison, which is great. And off the back of that success, just coming around and seeing the developments of the club, that opportunity to come again, I thought, maybe the restaurant shutting was sort of, it was meant to happen, which I think it probably did. It was coming to the end of, I think, of its time. And it's time to do something new. And I think this has been a massive breath of fresh air. It's been something very different to what I'd normally do. I've done some stuff down the cricket before at Edgbaston. And I just thought, I love the place, the people. I recognise some of the people that have been here for years. And then obviously new faces that are coming with new ideas and trying to redevelop the club, which you can clearly see they are. Yeah. It's great to be part of that journey. Mm. It's a bit of a dream come true, really. Mm. The only thing which I didn't realise is that I like to make a sacrifice of mine. Normally on match day, I'd have like six pints down the roost and then watch the game. This weekend,
you had six fights in the kitchen.
So unfortunately, I did get one in. To be honest with you, peeling onions, and I missed the fucking game.
Living the dream.
Sacrifice.
You sort of think yourself, was it the dream? I think the dream was in the roost having 6 points. I can't even enjoy the success because I can't see it.
It's going to not tell it.
I mean, the shit. It's
live thing, the screen. Look in the back of the chip shop, just a little off course.
So I'm about to make sacrifices. But you know what? I had a great, the first day was great down here against Exeter. And yeah, we've got plenty more planned to come front. So yeah, I'm buzzing.
Perfect. Just finally then, what aspirations of the future are you doing for that?
I have got a meeting today, actually, about a new site in the city centre. A slightly different concept. Obviously, I'd like to continue working with Blues, which we signed you for. A little tapas bar, that's ticking over quite nice. I'm waiting for the weather to get better. So that sort of food route all opens up and stuff on Edmund Street. The pub's doing really well, got a few events there. Fly fishing season starts on the 22nd of February. Looking forward to that.
I think
enjoy what I do and embrace any new challenges at just trying to be a Dan's Dan, just a good bloke. That's the way I'm not. That's my new focus to 2025.
Love it, Mark.
And obviously promotion.
Obviously. Yeah, that's under.
Thanks, Mark. Cheers, Alex. Thank you.
Cheers, Alex. Thank you.